This episode is sponsored by Anchor by Spotify. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast, and Ashley and I can definitely personally vouch for this. First of all, it saves you a bunch of time, so we don't really talk about this, but Ashley and I both have full-time jobs, and we don't really live close by each other, so we just get together once a week, every week, and talk about our podcast, and Anchor.fm helps us a lot to get everything out there and ready to go for you all to listen to with not a lot of time needed. So first of all, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and many more. There are also creation tools right in Anchor that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or from your computer.
Also, Anchor is free, and even though you don't have to pay any money, it actually allows you to make money from your own podcast even without a minimum number of listeners. It's everything you could possibly need to make a podcast for free in one place.
So if you can't already tell, we both love Anchor. And if you're interested in starting a podcast of your own, download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Hi, listeners, and welcome to Above the Wing, a podcast to bring together all aspects of the aviation community, including engineers, journalists, mechanics, pilots, and even casual hobbyists. I'm your co-host, Kim.
And I'm your co-host, Ashley. We'll talk about all things aviation, from current events to new products and airplanes, to industry trends and everything in between. Looking at our first in the news article for this week, Hyundai Motor Group has unveiled a new plan to build an ecosystem for advanced air mobility, including flying cars and related infrastructure, in Indonesia's new capital city of Nusantara that is currently under construction. Under this agreement, the two sides will work on issues such as establishing the concept of land-air mobility integration, testing advanced air mobility vehicles, and building related infrastructure and ecosystems. Hyundai has also expressed high expectations for the new project, which aims to provide an efficient model for the advanced air mobility ecosystem and ultimately enhance quality of life for residents of the island.
Moving on to our next headline, Etihad's Greenliner shows a glimpse of a more sustainable future for aviation. At the COP27 climate conference, some delegates arrived aboard emission-free flights, meaning that they were powered fully by sustainable aviation fuel. These flights were part of a program called Greenliner, run by Etihad Airways, the national carrier of the United Arab Emirates. The aviation industry is not currently on track to meet its net zero target by 2050, and two-thirds of that transition relies on SAF, or sustainable aviation fuel. Now, SAF only accounts for 1% of global jet fuel usage. The head of sustainability at Etihad, Maryam Al-Kwabasi, said that the Greenliner program is essentially a call to action. The idea came about in late 2019 to launch the message to the industry, let's try everything possible to decarbonize. In addition to SAF, Greenliner has tackled issues such as plastic waste and inefficient flight routes.
Looking at our next article, Honeywell's 31st Annual Global Business Aviation Outlook has forecasted up to 8,500 new business jet deliveries worth $274 billion from 2023 to 2032. Which is up 15% in both deliveries and expenditures from the same 10-year forecast a year ago. Forecast aligns with industry reports of sold-out business jet production lines for the next several years, according to Honeywell officials. Honeywell Aerospace's president for aftermarket in the Americas, Heath Patrick, said, quote, "The business aviation industry is greatly benefiting from a wave of first-time users and buyers due in part to changing habits brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic."
Wrapping it up with our last headline, Sporty introduces their PJ2 Plus radio. Sporty recently upgraded its PJ2 handheld comm radio to the PJ2 Plus. The PJ2 Plus is the only handheld aviation radio that can be connected to standard aviation headset plugs without using a special adapter. Other upgrades include a 3.5mm jack that accommodates wired earbuds or computer-style headsets, 6 watts peak transmit power to maximize range, an automatic noise limiter, and a high-contrast backlit screen with glare-reducing face, making it easier to read in direct sunlight. The Director of Aviation Products and Marketing, Doug Ranley, said, quote, "An emergency is no time to be searching for a headset adapter or a user manual to figure out how to turn your radio on."
So moving into the bulk of our episode for this week we thought it would be sort of interesting to look at bird strikes, sort of the FAA requirements around them or, you know, guidelines. Some history of bird strikes since the start of flight, and some stats around how they occur, where they occur, things like that. To start, I figured I would take a look back to the first people to actually fly, and it turns out in 1905, Orville Wright was the first to report a bird strike. Happened while Orville was flying circles near a cornfield in Dayton, Ohio. He had apparently been chasing flocks of birds for a while before he inevitably hit one, and the bird landed on his wing until Orville made a sharp turn and he dumped it off. Cal Rogers, another aviation pioneer, had a bird strike, but his was a little more serious. He was piloting a Wright EX biplane that he called Vinfiz, and in 1911 he became the first person to cross the United States by air. Though during a demonstration in 1912, his aircraft collided with a seagull that became entangled in his control cables. Rogers lost control and then crashed into the Pacific. This was the first reported bird strike fatality. The first turbojet-powered airplane in Germany in 1939 also had a bird strike. Only 3 days after its first flight, that was the first jet pilot to report a bird strike. Bird was sucked into its engine, and it caused a loss of thrust, though the airplane did make a safe landing.
So it's interesting because the loss of thrust that Eric experienced in 1939 is still relevant today, and so relevant that the FAA and EASA have made specific certification standards to prevent this. So in terms of common bird strike locations, 44% of them occur at the engine, and that, you know, is why Eric lost thrusts. But that's not the only place where these bird strikes occur. 31% occur at the wing, 13% occur at the windshield, 8% occur at the nose, and 4% occur at the fuselage. But today I thought it would be interesting to dive into the 44% that occur at the engine, because the FAA has some pretty extensive certification documentation on what needs to be done to certify an aircraft engine. So there's an entire Part 33, subpart E specifically, and section 33.76 is titled Bird Ingestion. According to the FAA, ingestion tests must assess the impact of, quote, large single bird, the single largest medium bird which can enter the inlet, and the large flocking bird. So when I first read this, I was like, there are so many classifications of birds that I was not expecting. And how do they define these birds? So I kept scrolling through this document, this very lengthy document with a lot of fancy words. And this document defines in detail the weight requirements and quantity requirements for birds based on the engine inlet throw area. So they have a chart and you can look up, like, depending on how big your engine is, how heavy and how many birds you have to shoot through it. So here's an example. Medium birds are used to simulate a flock encounter. The bird is aimed at the engine core primary flow path and other, quote, critical locations on the engine area. So there's a lot of details in this
testing. Like, what do they, like, dare I ask, like, what they test with?
So that's a good question. That's a good segue, Ashley. So how do they get these birds into the engine? I did some more digging, and I feel like the people who come up with these names in the aviation and aerospace industry, they've got to be fun people. They use something called a chicken gun. So it's a compressed air gun used to fire birds at aircraft components to simulate bird strikes. The first recorded chicken gun was in 1942. By the U.S. Civil Aeronautics Administration in collaboration with Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company. And the first chicken gun fired birds at up to 400 miles per hour or 640 wow. kilometers per hour. And that was the first one. Like, today, they're firing them much faster.
That's crazy.
And not to mention, they have to use this chicken gun repeatedly as well. Because, like I said, they have to, you know, right. simulate a flock, for example.
That's awful.
Yeah, yeah.
They have to do it repeatedly, like with great accuracy as well. Like they have to aim it at the core primary flow, because otherwise you have to make sure that the engine won't lose thrust. The engine has to be tested to determine critical ingestion parameters affecting power loss and damage. So not only does it have to be accurate, but it has to be repeatable as well, so that you can have you know, adequate and sufficient data for all your engine certification tests.
Oh my gosh.
So this is a whole ordeal for the aircraft engine industry.
Well, you talked about different, you know, places on the airplane that could be affected by bird strikes, you know, the engine obviously being one of the biggest ones. But some airplanes can actually just be destroyed in general, you know, the whole airplane totaled from bird strikes. The largest commercial aircraft ever to be destroyed by a bird strike was DC-10. It was taking off from JFK in November of 1975, and the airliner flew through a flock of seagulls. Some were ingested into the number 3 engine, and that actually ultimately caused a fire in the right wing. Fortunately, though, the pilot successfully aborted the takeoff and was able to stop the plane on the taxiway, where everyone on board was able to be evacuated, though the fire did ultimately consume the DC-10. I also read that the worst bird strike, sort of on record here, was back in 1960, just after Eastern Airlines Flight 375, which is a Lockheed L-188 Electra, took off from Boston Logan Airport and ran into a flock of common starlings. It lost power in 3 engines, and the airliner crashed into Boston Harbor. 62 people died, and it was the greatest single loss of life from any bird strike.
And just to chime in into the already morbid list of fatalities and casualties from birds, the most recent accident was in January 15, 2009, and I remember hearing about this in the news at the time, but I had no idea that it was because of a bird strike. So it's interesting to read about, like in present day in 2022, knowing that it was a bird strike. But to cut to the chase, US Airways Flight 1549 landed in the Hudson River due to a bird strike on January 15, 2009. It was an Airbus A320 powered by 2 CFM International turbofan engines. It took off from LaGuardia, New York, and it intended to land in Charlotte, North Carolina, in Seattle, Washington. The pilot in command was Chesley Sully Sullenberger, and he was a former USAF fighter pilot. He had 19,663 flight hours, and 4,765 of those were on the A320. So this is all just to paint the story that this guy knew his stuff. This wasn't just an accident. And I think his experience made the difference in this accident. On the plane, there were 150 passengers, and there were three flight attendants. And once they got into the air, at 2,818 feet in altitude, or 859 meters, only 4.5 miles, or 7.2 kilometers from LaGuardia, the aircraft struck a flock of Canadian geese. So, you know, testing for flocks are important, it seems. Testimonials say that passengers and crew heard loud bangs, flames from engines, and they smelled fuel. The pilot, Sully, initially planned to land at nearby Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, but he quickly decided that the aircraft wouldn't make it. The aircraft passed less than 900 feet or 270 meters above the George Washington Bridge and landed in the Hudson. Passengers and crew evacuated. Luckily, no one was killed. There were 95 minor injuries and 5 serious injuries. So I thought this was pretty crazy. First of all, the pilot was able to crash land in the Hudson River, and he expertly maneuvered it around the George Washington Bridge, which is a pretty busy bridge. Mm-hmm. So if he had hit it would have been really bad. But like I said, his thousands of flight hours and his USAF experience definitely helped him out here. That goes to show that in present day aviation and aerospace, this is still like a super relevant topic. And despite all the FAA regulations, it still has to be like very stringently watched and things like that, because it can clearly have some some pretty serious consequences.
Yeah, this is one of those things where it's like, what is the end to this issue? You know, like, I don't know if you'll ever, like, you're never going to stop bird strikes, right? Like,
no.
So, I mean, like, you talked about the testing and stuff, like, I mean, is, you know, that's where the importance is can these airplanes make it through those bird strikes when they happen safely?
Mm-hmm. And as I was reading it, you know, this was an A320, so it was a full commercial aircraft. Mm-hmm. And last episode, we talked about portable oxygen and how it was bringing GA pilots to higher altitudes.
Right.
And GA pilots have smaller engines, smaller aircraft as a whole. So how will it affect them? Like you talked about the first turbojet powered airplane.
Right.
And luckily, the example that you talked about in Germany, the pilot was able to land safely. But,
right.
You know, as smaller airplanes go higher, will this be more of a problem for them?
Well, and I feel like two smaller airplanes share more space with birds than airliners probably do.
Yeah.
I mean, we hear about bird strikes happening in GA all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's less in the GA world, it's less where they're going into their engines. They're more just
hitting
the sputtering all over their windows. Like, yeah. I mean, it's awful, but like,
yeah.
That's just more of what it, and then you just sort of deal with it when you land, like,
yeah.
So it's a problem in both industries, but a vastly different one just based on like size and yeah.
Yeah. And the statistics that I said earlier about common bird strike locations, mm-hmm. those are mostly for commercial aircraft.
Right.
Yeah. Which does make sense too, because, you know, GA aircraft just have smaller surface area.
Right. Yeah. Too. A lot of times they move slower.
Yeah.
So give the bird a couple minutes, get out of the way.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So it's all interesting stuff. And I feel like these, it sounds silly. Like talking about it in real life, like right. I never thought I would be in a podcast talking about bird
strikes.
Yeah.
Well, Kim, you know, it's in my research. I actually found that it is more than just birds.
Oh,
that the FAA warns pilots about. Their official reports actually refer to bird strikes instead as wildlife strikes, because. Though a small number, actually 5% of all strikes involve something other than a bird. Some things like moose and caribou have been struck by aircraft in Alaska. Florida has seen collisions with alligators. Gopher tortoise strikes are increasing. Armadillos have been hit in Texas, antelope in Arizona.
I don't even know what a gopher tortoise looks like.
You know, just a little turtle-like thing crawling across the runway. And though leading that list of otherwise pretty unique animals are the white-tailed deer, which over 1,000 deer strikes were recorded in the FAA's 24-year study period. And significant damage is typical due to hitting one of these white-tailed deer. Right under that, the deer on the list are coyote, with more than 400 collisions. All in all, the FAA has 42 species of terrestrial mammals on their list of wildlife strikes, and 11 different species of reptiles that have been involved in these accidents.
This is blowing my mind.
I know. You don't really think about like what's crawling on the runway.
I know.
On your takeoff roll. You never know what you're going to... what you're gonna find.
So I know that airframers will test their, for example, their windshields,
mm-hmm. sure.
for strength to make sure yep. that it, like a bird, won't shatter it. But does this mean like
a deer or a moose is another story?
Yeah, on the ground. Like, yep. Does this mean that airframers have to reinforce their body to make sure or to prevent against serious damage while taking off on the runway?
That's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to like the manufacturer and what they intend these aircraft to be made for, right? I mean, you think of bush planes. These are planes that are out in Alaska, in, you know, like other densely populated, or not densely populated, like wooded or tougher to get to areas where you probably have a higher risk of animal life being around.
It's true.
So, yeah. I think it's also an interesting thing to think about too, like airport location. So like my home airport is in sort of a wooded area and close to a river. So, you know, naturally there are fox and deer running around sometimes. So something to think about too, like where an airport is located and how that comes into play.
Have you ever encountered wildlife while taking off?
No.
I think that's a good thing.
Yes. Yeah.
I've heard like tales of like in Florida waiting for an alligator to cross the runway to take off.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I know, isn't it?
That's like I said earlier, this stuff is definitely not things that you think about. Like,
right.
When I'm going on a trip to an airport, I'm never going to think about,
that's oh not, my God, yeah.
What if a bird hits this plane?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're thinking about like getting through the TSA pre-check line.
I know. Seriously. You know?
Like, yeah.
Like little do I know that there's so much testing and everything that that is going on behind the scenes to get that engine on the aircraft or to get the freaking airplane built.
Right.
To make sure that the birds won't hurt the plane.
Yep. I know. It's crazy stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting.
It's such a weird like subsect. Important. Like important and, you know, contributes to safety, but such a niche like area.
Yeah. That's what another reason why I think aviation and aerospace is so interesting. There's so many little niches and pockets of stuff that you don't think about in everyday life. And it's fun to just deep dive into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
You never know what I'm going to find. Like, I did not expect myself to be reading about a chicken gun on a regular weekday evening.
Why else would you?
Yeah, exactly. But I learned so much.
Sure did.
Well, that wraps it up for us this week. Thanks for listening to the, albeit morbid, but we thought it was pretty interesting to talk about episode. And we'll see you in our next one.
Thanks for listening.